All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I think it's an accident, but I think I figured out that it's a good strategy to wait to interview Tom Woods until the last half hour of the 3-hour show and not tell you when he's coming on. That way you'll pay attention to the rest of the stuff, because I know y'all just want to hear Tom Woods. Senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, that's Mises.org, keeper of the website, TomWoods.com, and author of some of these books, many of these books, all these books and more than these books, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, Who Killed the Constitution? Some of these are co-authors. 33 Questions You're Not Supposed to Ask About American History, We Who Dared Say No to War, American Anti-War Writing from 1812 through Now, Meltdown, A Free Market Look at Why the Economic Crisis is All the Government's Fault, Nullification, How to Resist Federal Tyranny in the 21st Century, Rollback, Repealing Big Government Before the Coming Fiscal Collapse, and now what's this? Back on the Road to Serfdom, The Resurgence of Statism. Tom, another new book from you?
It's a collection of essays. I wrote the introduction, so I can't claim it as a full book.
Oh, I got you. It's a great introduction, though, right?
It's worth the price of the book, naturally.
Of course. All right, so, the great Tom Woods, tell us. And I know that you covered this in your book with co-author with Kevin Gutzman, Who Killed the Constitution. Tell us, and not from your twisted ideological point of view, just give us the facts. What war powers does the American president retain, or what powers was he delegated in the U.S. Constitution of 1789, sir?
Okay. Well, basically what I've been talking about over the past few days specifically involves what powers does he have to commit people to battle, to actually initiate military force, which is the key thing. Because he has some powers that he shares with the Senate, but for example, involving ambassadors and so on, and treaty making. But what I've been focusing on specifically, because of obviously the current context, is what are his powers to actually deploy troops? And basically the answer is this, that initially the Constitution was going to say that the Congress will have the power to make war. And they changed that to say the Congress will have the power to declare war. The president does indeed have a power to make war, but what's meant by that word is it's meant in a very restrictive sense. It's meant that if there really were some case, like these hypotheticals they're always throwing up at us, like some case where it's so urgent, we're about to be attacked by all the countries of the world coming after us all at once, and the president can't spare the 15 minutes it would take to get the congressman in session and get their declaration of war, well, strictly speaking, he can repel an attack if it is, you know, it's one that's actually launched on the country. And so a defensive action, now whether this is wise or not is another question, but the point is that a defensive action is within his power. So, for example, George Washington engaged in this against the Indians, but then he said, if you want me to engage in offensive actions, I would have to go to Congress for that. Likewise, Jefferson and the Barbary Pirates, he's sending ships for defensive purposes to protect U.S. lives. And he said, but if this were to be a matter of offensive operations, then again, I would have to get further authorization from Congress. So that's basically it. So that, in other words, non-defensive deployment of troops requires Congress either to declare war or by statute to authorize the president to engage in measures short of war, or we might say small, little wars, minor skirmishes, that sort of thing. But the initiative rests with Congress, and the commander-in-chief power the president enjoys kicks in once the hostilities have been authorized by the Congress. They don't give him the power to himself initiate them.
All right, now here's the thing. Where does it say that in the Constitution?
Where does it say, what, the things that I just said?
Yeah, well, specifically, I'm sorry, the part about the president has the right to repel an attack from the Red Indians or anybody else without Congress giving them the authority to do it. I mean, of course, we would all think, well, geez, if there's, you know, nuclear bombs coming over the North Pole, somebody's got to do something. You might think, forget the rule of law then, but the law still says only Congress can authorize the president to act, right? So I don't see where all this wiggle room is in the text of the thing.
Well, in the text of the thing, it is tricky. That's true.
And I mean, it sounds like there's a lot more wiggle room than the right-wing AM hosts who you're bashing are successfully bashing
our
claim.
You know, I'm just telling you honestly what's there. I mean, this isn't what I support, or I'm just telling you what my reading leads me to conclude.
Okay, and, but I mean, which part, though, is... I'm just trying to get a little clarification of which part of Article What says that.
Well, I mean, I don't see it. I don't see it. But what I do know is that the deliberate attempt, or the deliberate changing of make to declare, basically everybody took to mean that, well, therefore we're not depriving the president of this power to do this in an emergency case, that we can't rely on Congress in that type of emergency. But
oh, I see. But, so no, you're saying this all really comes down to the argument in the constitutional convention.
In the constitutional text, I don't think it's very easy to find that. But I'm just telling you that if you were to go to constitutional intent, you can find arguments to this effect in the debate. But in a way, even though this is a tricky issue, this is neither here nor there, because 99.9% of the military interventions that U.S. presidents have engaged in have not involved, you know, the enemy is at the gates, we've got 15 seconds to decide what to do. I mean, in fact, the one time that that sort of did happen, or I guess one of a couple of times, but with Pearl Harbor, where there actually was an attack on the U.S., FDR went to Congress. I mean, he actually went and got the declaration. He did not say, hey, look, everybody, we've just been attacked. I don't have time to wait 24 hours to call Congress into session. This has to be done right now. Likewise with Libya. I mean, could it really be seriously...
Well,
composed?
George Bush got permission, got authorization, not a declaration, but authorization from Congress before he attacked Afghanistan, even.
Well, that's true. Well, what I was just going to say just quickly about Libya, I was going to say that this is obviously an example of something that I hardly think this was a case where, A, Gaddafi was about to invade, or B, that if we had just waited, I hate to say we, sorry, if they had just waited another 3 hours, everything would have collapsed. I mean, none of this would hold in that case. But in what with regard to Bush and Afghanistan or even Iraq, the key issue there involves the wording of the statements. I mean, the Congress can't delegate to the president the power to decide on war, to say, look, you know, whatever you decide to do one way or the other, we just sort of, in advance, we just declare we support it. They can no more delegate that power to him than they can delegate the power to levy taxes on the population to him and say, look, whatever, you know, we have the power to tax, but whatever you want to do, you know, we'll just rubber stamp that afterward. That's not how it's supposed to work.
Right. And now, in Obama's speech last night, he had a couple of words to say about the Congress. And so what he said was, 9 days ago, after consulting the bipartisan leadership of Congress, I authorized military action under a U.N. mandate. Does that sound legal enough? He's got a U.N. mandate.
Well, and he talked to a few congressmen, so apparently that's all we need. Well, no, none of that is the case. I mean, number one, talking to a few congressmen is not the same thing as actually having Congress authorize what you're doing. But of course, the leadership are the creepiest ones of all of them. But secondly, the UN thing, there's a lot of misunderstanding about this, and I have a piece that I wrote that, in fact, antiwar.com ran the other day, called "The Phony Case for Presidential War Powers," and you can read it at, I just put it up at tomwoods.com, right there on my blog. And this actually links to stuff specifically on the UN, so that when that issue is raised, you have all the documentation in front of you. But to make a long story short, the UN Charter even makes clear that if you are engaged in some kind of military action at the behest of the United Nations, that military action on the part of each country has to be done through their constitutional processes.
Because even the U.S. Congress wouldn't have passed the Participation Act without that in there.
Without some assurance to that effect. Exactly right.
All right. Hang tight right there, y'all. It's Tom Woods, Mises.org, TomWoods.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Tom Woods. He's the author of every book that was ever written. And he keeps the website TomWoods.com. Well, a majority of the books that were ever written, you know. Constantly cranking out new ones all the time. All right, so we're talking about the war powers of the president. This is all a moot point because the Constitution's been a dead letter since when? Andrew Jackson or even George Washington, you know. Thomas Jefferson resigned. And he told George Washington, if you pass this banking act, which it does not say in Article 1, Section 8, Congress can pass it, and that means you can't sign it. And if you do, you will be stepping foot onto a boundless field of power from which there is no return. And it will mean that the president can do whatever he wants to whoever he wants, whenever he wants, simple as that. It seems to me like Jefferson was right, and in fact, his own presidency proves the case.
Yeah, well, look, I hold no brief for the Constitution. I mean, obviously the thing hasn't worked. I mean, don't give me this. Well, it would work if only we enforced it. Aha! But you see, that's the issue here. That I mean, if it's this difficult to enforce that it can go ignored for decades and decades and centuries, maybe there's something wrong with it. You know, like if it were anything other than the Constitution, like, you know, if I had a video game machine that just consistently just emitted smoke and played no video games, I would not stand there and say, well, you know what? If I just keep turning it on day after day after day, maybe something will come of this. I mean, I would conclude maybe the thing is broken. Like, maybe something's got to be done different from this. But having said that, nevertheless, you know, I am, maybe it's just because I'm a vindictive SOB, and I don't think I am. But I do have this streak in me that when I'm up against somebody I consider to be evil, and this is not just a matter of, you know, hey, well, we've got an understandable disagreement over, you know, patents or copyrights, but like we're really good and evil facing each other. I feel like I want to defeat this person on every conceivable ground. I want to defeat him on the moral grounds, historical grounds, practical grounds, and constitutional grounds, because I don't want this person to be able to say, ah, this pie in the sky Woods, you know, libertarian, he's got these crazy theories, but I've got the U.S. Constitution. I want to show him that in spite of the fact that the Constitution has been, trampled on and ripped to shreds, he doesn't even have that. I mean, like, you have got nothing to stand on other than your imperial ambitions.
Mm. All right, now, I don't know if there's a way to get to any optimism anywhere in this interview, Tom, but I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about your book, Rollback. You basically make the case in there that never mind your ideology or whether you got any beliefs at all, the fact of the matter is the American society must separate itself and, you know, basically repeal the entire American federal state because we have to, because we just cannot afford this thing and the liabilities that it has placed on the future taxpayers of this country and future productivity of this country, that we just have no choice now, that they've, you know, if they've driven us at least to the edge of the cliff, if not over.
Yeah, that's basically it. The first chapter of Rollback makes the case for that, and as far as I can see, it just can't be refuted. And there are people on the left and on the right, and libertarians, who will agree at least on these facts that yes, and they may disagree on what we need to do about it. But I don't think there's any disagreeing that when you have unfunded liabilities, like for these entitlement programs, that exceed the entire GDP of the world, you know, like maybe that means you can't do this. Like maybe you have to change course at some point. That's what we're facing. And then meanwhile, we've got Republicans who want to cut $61 billion, which, I mean, you know, that's not even like one-tenth of a fingernail, you know, off of Andre the Giant. I mean, it's...
Well, and you leave it to them, the first thing they'll do is turn the mentally ill out of the state hospitals and you know, pick on the black single mothers and the Mexican illegal immigrants that work for black market below minimum wages and the very weakest among us. Glenn Greenwald had a piece, they're turning off the street lights, the roads are going unpaved, the American municipal utility districts and county court level agencies of government all across this country, the state bailouts, just look at those. America is busted, and yet the empire will be the last thing to go. At the rate we're going, the president, his war power still rules all.
Yeah, and then meanwhile, we've got this naive confidence. Nevertheless, even today, we have people who still kind of think that, well, gosh, where would we be, though, without the political class? You know, they're really just looking out for you and me, when in fact we all know that, you know, if you run GE, you can pick up the phone and basically TARP occurs. You know, I mean, you can pick up the phone, and the whole the commercial paper market gets bailed out. You know, the money markets get bailed out. I mean, you pick up the phone and say, hey, we're in some trouble. And yeah, and GE should be in some trouble. I mean, they had a lot of phony baloney paper profits that were about to be wiped out. They deserve to be punished for overstating their profits and for financing their business the way they did. But no, that's not going to happen to them. No, because both parties will come rushing to the rescue. Oh my gosh, what can we do for you, GE? What is it you need? There's always, yeah, they can't pave the roads, but if they need to bomb a guy that 5 minutes ago they thought was perfectly fine. I mean, really, McCain was perfectly fine with Gaddafi, apart from, you know, a couple of perfunctory remarks about, well, you know, I'm a little unsure about his human rights record or something. But I mean, you know, but they can always find money for that. And I realize that when I say this, I sound like the people when I was growing up. I would see the bumper stickers that would say, you know, wouldn't it be great if we lived in a world in which, you know, the schools had all the resources they needed, but the Pentagon had to have a bake sale. And I used to think, oh gosh, these people are so hopeless. But man, like they were much closer to the truth than I was.
Yeah, you know, there's a Ike Eisenhower's speech, which, you know, of course, this is all his fault, the Barack Obama of his day. But he gave a speech before the military-industrial complex.
I know
speech.
Exactly the one you're talking about. Roger Waters quoted from it in his rendition of The Wall recently.
Oh, really?
He had just read it quoted in a newspaper article in England, and he said, I had no idea that Eisenhower would have said something like this, and I thought it was the most beautiful thing. It's the speech about how every person who is, or every bomb that's dropped and all these things are a theft from everyone who is cold and not clothed and hungry and not fed. Is it that speech?
Yeah, and he talks about, you know, how many schoolhouses could you build? How many roads could you pave? How much America could we build with the money that's spent instead? And he itemizes it by battleship, by bomber, et cetera, like that.
Yeah, that, and of course, you know, what are you going to say about Dwight Eisenhower, that he was some commie pinko? I mean, he's Dwight Eisenhower. He's as establishment as it gets.
Yeah, well, that was the grandfather in him on his way out of power. Was like, all right, look, you know, I kind of got a couple things to get off my chest here.
Yeah, exactly. So Rollback was my new book, which I think is the best thing I've done for what that's worth. But it really, you know, it's one of these things where it kind of traps you in there. Like it's the sort of book that if a Tea Party guy picked it up, he'd say, all right, I got to see what we can do to push back against Obama. Obama's terrible. Well, yeah, I mean, any 10-year-old who has an internet connection can see Obama's terrible. Like, they're all terrible. I mean, that's just the way the system is. They're going to be terrible. But, and I talk about Obama, all right, fine. But the point is that as you get deeper and deeper and as the chapters go by, then we're peeling away more and more layers of the onion. We're getting to the military-industrial complex. We're getting to some of these sorts of questions that, you know, shall we say, are not exactly burning up the Tea Party circuit, but that these people, above all, need to hear about.
Right. Well, that's all you got to do is just keep attacking the right from the right. And the truth is, if true conservatism, if the essence of conservatism is conserving the original classical liberalism of the American Revolution, then you got purity on your side. And if you can define right-wing beliefs in that way, which I think you can, Tom. I think you are doing. I think you can change a hell of a lot of minds. I know that you already have. But, you know, here's the thing, and this is what the book Rollback is for especially, but it's people are afraid of the unknown. And really, like, if I Dream a Genie could just blink that national government out of existence, whatever would we do? What would America look like? Wouldn't the evil capitalists with the top hats run off with everything? Or wouldn't the poor burn everything down? Or you know, what terrible anarchy might ensue if you had your way? That's what people have in the back of their head here, Tom.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of these questions that, you know, there's no quick radio answer. I mean, Rollback is part of the answer, and Bob Murphy has part of the answer. But by and large, you know, my answer would be that, you know, I've given this analogy before. If we were educated by Walmart instead of by the government, and the Walmart told us we would die without them, we wouldn't believe it. So we shouldn't believe it now either.
Yeah, right on for that. I agree. And certainly a lot of people will die with them. I know that.
Yeah, you're darn right.
All right, everybody, that is the great Tom Woods. Thanks very much for your time, Tom.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, y'all. TomWoods.com, Mises.org. Check out his many, many wonderful, awesome, incredible, bargain-priced books at Amazon.com and wherever else. See y'all tomorrow.